As I begin, I'm going to ask a simple question. Who do you think is the most prolific author in the world? It is James Patterson. According to Nelson BookScan, he has sold more books in the past decade than any other writer. Patterson initially made his mark as a crime novelist, but he's branched out in the past recent years to other genres. He's also allied himself, if you will, with other writers, so he's co-written a number of books, but it's allowed him to just explode in terms of volume of what he can write. He started out his career as an advertising executive and actually started writing novels in 1976, and as the novels began to do well, he retired from advertising in 1996 and began writing full-time. Patterson holds the New York Times record for the most number one New York Times bestsellers by a single author. That total is 67. He is also, this is also a Guinness World Record. His novels account, I found this one very interesting. His novels account for roughly 6% of all hardcover novels sold in the United States. One author. To date, he has written and sold more than 300 million copies of more than 147 novels worldwide. You might ask yourself, how does Patterson do this? That's quite a volume of work, isn't it? Well, it was asked of him in an interview how he did it. This was his answer. He says, I'm usually up by 5:30-ish. I will write for an hour or so, then quickly blast through the highlights of a few newspapers. Frequently, then, I will go and walk the golf course for maybe an hour. I'm usually back here by 9:30 or so, right till noon, go to lunch with my wife, come back and write some more. From Patterson's perspective, creating such a volume of work is primarily from putting in the time. But it's also the discipline of putting in that time. He has established a habit, if you will, of writing. There's something to learn from individuals like James Patterson, especially as we apply it on a spiritual level. For instance, what is a major theme of the upcoming Days of Unleavened Bread? I think all of us would probably come out at some point with coming out of sin, or to put it in a more succinct way, overcoming. We know this. We hear sermons about it on a regular basis, but the reality of overcoming sin is at times a deep and hard struggle, isn't it? There can be even maybe a sin in our lives that we never seem to overcome. Why is that? And how do we address it? The question I want to ask and explore this afternoon in the sermon is this question here. Can we make a habit of overcoming? Might seem to be an odd way to frame it. I'm going to flesh that out here a little bit more as we go along. But our default in overcoming sin is that we usually hope for God to change our carnal nature, and poof, that sin is magically gone out of our life. Or maybe we think that with enough willpower, we can overcome some aspect of our carnal nature. We might even think that some aspects of that character that we're trying to develop will never change until God gives us eternal life. But as we approach Passover and the Days of Unleavened Bread and consider this theme of overcoming sin, we need to connect it with some things. And one of the things is to consider the impact of sin in our lives. And so we're going to look at a couple of scriptures as we begin here. Let's look at Revelation chapter 2. I'm just going to pull some highlights out of a couple of chapters. Because as John recorded what Christ was revealing to him, there is a consistent thought, if you will, between all of these letters, all these various churches, as John was talking to them, of what Christ expected of them. They all had different characteristics and attitudes, if you will, and yet there was still something in common that they needed to address. And so in Revelation 2, if we just look at verse 7, as John concludes the comments here to the first of the churches, that is Ephesus, he says there, "To him who overcomes, I will give to eat from the tree of life." In verse 11, he says the same thing about the church at Smyrna. "He who overcomes shall not be hurt by the second death." John continues this thought as he progresses through these various churches. Verse 26, He who overcomes and keeps my works till the end. Every church had the responsibility to overcome. Let's couple that with the thought in 1 Corinthians 11 and in verse 28. As the Apostle Paul wrote about Passover specifically in this section of this chapter, he makes a statement I think most of us are familiar with, and that is to examine ourselves. I'll flesh that out a little bit after we read the verse. So 1 Corinthians 11, verse 28 says, "But let a man examine himself, and so let him eat of the bread and drink of the cup." The point of examining is not so that we get to a point where we say, "I shouldn't do this. My sins are too big. I've not been able to overcome them. I'm not worthy for whatever reasons." That's not why we're to examine ourselves. Notice, we examine ourselves so that we can eat the bread, drink the wine. But we know ourselves better than anyone else, don't we? We know what's in our head, not just what we say and what we do, whatever we happen to do or say publicly to sort of make ourselves look better or to protect ourselves or to not be embarrassed, right or wrong. The reality is, in our minds, we're different than what we show everybody, aren't we? We're left with the true reality of who and what we are. So I'm going to propose what may be a radical thought to you today. I believe that we can overcome any aspect of our carnal nature by establishing a positive habit to replace it. I asked in my specific purpose question, can we make a habit of overcoming? And I believe the answer is yes. Because that's what we'll look at in the balance here. There are positive things that we can put into practice on a physical level that can impact that spiritual development. We can grow in God's grace and in His Holy Spirit through establishing positive habits, just like we establish habits for so many other things in life. But it's easy to think at times of habits as only being negative, especially as we consider 1 Corinthians 11, 28. As we examine ourselves, we tend to look at the things that we're not doing well. But what about the things that we're doing right? You know, habits are not just bad things, chewing on your fingernails or, you know, overcoming something like smoking or eating too much or wanting to exercise more, things of this nature. Maybe we don't give habits much thought because we become so comfortable with them. Our lives, our daily lives, are filled with habits that we don't think about. Some of them are neutral. If we're not careful, you get up in the morning, you get ready and you go to work, you probably don't even think about how you drive to work, do you? I've done that at times. I'm driving down the road and it's like, oh, I'm almost home. Because it's what you do. It's the pattern. We can do those things without thinking. But the really interesting thing is I've researched this topic is that there's mounting evidence that shows that not only can we overcome habits, but that we can choose the habits we have. We don't simply have to accept what we develop unconsciously. Any regular sin we struggle with is simply a habit that we have established. Maybe you've never thought about it in that regard. But it is, in simple terms, that's the reality of it. If we see sin in that light, then sin becomes a habit that we can overcome. And more importantly, we can replace it with godly character and habits. The really interesting thing in considering habits is that the reason why we have them is that our brain is lazy. It's always looking for the easy way to do something, the quick way or the way that generates the most positive response. We can see that individually because there are things that I would do that you would say, why does he do that? Well, your brain doesn't think the same way. Your brain is looking for different solutions. But a problem is not something huge. It can be as simple as going back to the driving analogy. How can I get to work the quickest without the least amount of fuss and interaction with other terrible drivers? And so I pick a way that makes that solvable. So that habit solved a problem. I don't want to deal with traffic. I don't want to deal with the terrible drivers. I don't want to deal with a lot of time on the road. And so your brain says, well, let's do this. And we find a solution. We say, yes, that's a good solution. I'll do that every day. And that's life. Unfortunately, we can do that with sin as well. Before I go any further, I want to back up and give you a little bit of history, because this is not a recent development in terms of considering how we can overcome certain things and how the nature, the environment around us impacts us. But going back to the 1930s, there were behavioral psychologists like B.F. Skinner who took a look at what developed in terms of habits, why they took place, what influenced human behavior. He is the gentleman on the left on the screen up there. What he found was that there's a behavioral loop that is at the center of almost all of this response, and he calls it, or called it, stimulus response reward. So looking at the environment would, to use a simple example, it's too hot. The room is too hot. What are you going to do about that? So the stimulus is the heat. The response is, what am I going to do about that? Well, I have several choices, don't I? I can let it get hotter. I can just deal with it the way it is, or I can try to make it cooler, depending on what I want the reward to be. If I want it cooler, then I can either turn down the heat, or I can open a window, or I can turn a fan on, something to reply to that. And so that's the loop, he says. And we do it for all kinds of things. This is very similar to what Pavlov discovered with his famous dog. This is also called conditioned response. Skinner and Pavlov were looking primarily, though, at external stimuli that influence behavior, things outside of us. What's changed more recently is that individuals have begun to look at stimuli internally, things like emotions or feelings or beliefs, because they can have an equally powerful impact on the habits that we end up having. So in the last couple of years, as I said, there have been a good push, if you will, to address this. And I've read a couple of really good books recently that flesh out some of these observations of men like Skinner and Pavlov. But these newer writers are looking at how behavior can be addressed internally, not just externally influenced. One such book I read about a year or so ago, the title is The Power of the Habit, or Power of Habit, by Charles Duhigg. Duhigg showed what he highlighted as cue routine and reward. So a cue could be anything. You have a thought, and so then that thought helps to establish a routine, because that routine brings a reward. Very similar loop, but looking internally. These can shape our habits. They can change our behavior. If we're not careful, we can allow emotions to do this. So the drive to work, no matter how easy you try to make it, maybe you still deal with horrible traffic, and worse, you're dealing with horrible drivers. Well, the cue could be as simple as you're getting ready to walk out the door, you're already thinking about that. The routine is the drive, and the reward is how you respond to that. Maybe you try to tune out, play something on the radio, music, whatever station you want to listen to, or maybe you have recorded things you plug in through your phone or other devices, whatever it happens to be. The second book that I read expands on that thought, I think, in a better way. This book is entitled Atomic Habits, written by a man named James Clear. Mr. Clear also has several videos online that you could watch discussing various aspects of changing habits, and he's made the rounds with some of the morning news programs and various shows in the morning. But he uses different wording to describe what he sees as being effective in changing habits. His is cue, craving, response, and reward. And the difference is there that what he sees is that the cue can bring up a craving. You don't even have to start the action simply by thinking of it. You have a craving. So maybe you like chocolate. And just thinking about chocolate makes you want to crave the chocolate. And having craved the chocolate, then you want to go find some to be able to eat the chocolate. And the reward is having the chocolate. Atomic habits. He uses that term because he believes it's the small actions, the very small actions that build up to create something bigger. And so the smallest thing we know of generally speaking, are atoms. Everything's made up of atoms. You add those atoms together in various ways, and you have all sorts of things that we're familiar with around us in the natural world. But those atomic habits are something that are a regular practice or routine that is very small. But because it's easy to do, it's also the source of incredible power. And he had a quote that really resonated with me that I'll give you at this point. He said, "The quality of our lives often depend upon the quality of our habits." So think about that. For someone that smokes, the quality of that habit is not very good, is it? It's going to create all kinds of health problems. It can have other negative consequences. Their clothes are regularly going to smell of that. It'll stain their fingernails, and you know, they'll have to deal with the ashtrays and the various things. You know, all kinds of things that come into play on this and impact the quality of that. Well, I want to expand that thought a little bit as we're considering something more spiritually minded here. The quality of our spiritual life often depends upon the quality of our spiritual habits. What are your spiritual habits? Not judging. I'm simply asking the question, especially in light of the verses that we read earlier. If we're to examine ourselves and if we're to overcome, we have to know where we are. We have to know where our habits are, what they are, before we begin to even analyze them, let alone decide if we need to change them. So we could take this any number of ways, and oftentimes we think of it in terms of what we're lacking. There may be an element of truth to that, but it's more a matter of where we want to be. So does my spiritual life depend on things like knowing Greek or Hebrew? Might be nice, but no, it doesn't depend on it. Is my spiritual level of maturity verified by being able to quote Scripture all the time? Or do I need to be, in terms of character, somebody like Paul or Noah or Rachel or Sarah? I mean, name your personality from Scripture. I want to ask a question here as we begin to address some of these things. Why is sin so hard to overcome? I don't know if you've ever thought of it. If it was not hard to overcome, then we wouldn't have it in our lives, would we? Even if we sinned, we could say, you know what, I'm going to do that anymore. And we just walk away from it. Let's go to Hebrews 12, verse 1 there. Paul makes an interesting statement here as he transitions from the examples of faith in chapter 11. We'll read one such in just a moment. But then he moves it forward. So in verse 1, chapter 12, he says, "Therefore we also, in light of those examples, we as well are surrounded by a great cloud of witnesses," meaning we have their examples. We have the good and the bad and everything in between, don't we? You look at a life like David, and you can see the things that he did really well, and you can see the things that he didn't do very well at all. But we can learn from that, can't we? Both examples, both sides of that. So he says, we're surrounded by this. So let us lay aside every weight and the sin which so easily ensnares us. Paul acknowledged this. Sin easily ensnares us, and that's the definition of a snare. The prey doesn't know that it's a snare. And they think this is something easy, free food. Look at this. And then they're caught in the trap. He says, so let us run with endurance the race set before us. So keeping that in mind, let's go back to chapter 11. And in verse 24, I'm going to use the example of Moses and some of the things that he faced. Now, Moses, I think we all know the story. Delivered in the basket, Pharaoh's daughter draws him out, takes him in as her own son, raises him as royalty. And he was probably, in terms of ascension, either second or third in line for the throne of Egypt. So there was nothing that would have been withheld from him. Money, power, influence, he could have had everything or anything that he wanted. But he decided he didn't want that. By faith, Moses, when he became of age, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter. He decided to walk away from all of it. Notice verse 25, choosing rather to suffer affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the passing pleasure of sin. One of the things that we need to recognize in being able to overcome sin is that if it has any pleasure, it's passing. It's temporary. One of the things that's connected with it, not only being passing and temporary, is that it's usually extracting a high cost. We don't usually see that up front, or we wouldn't engage in it. We sin because there is some measure of pleasure in sinning, right? You burn yourself once, you say, I'm not going to do that again. But unfortunately with sin, we don't see that up front. So we do the sin and there's some reward, isn't there? There's a cue. We see something we want that God says, don't do that. But then we decide to follow through on it. We think the reward is good, but the reward is not good. If there wasn't any pleasure or gratification in sinning, then we wouldn't do it. But when we repeat a sin, then we begin to develop a habit. Even physically, part of the problem we have in sinning is that every habit brings a level of pleasure. And this goes beyond even sinning. Anything we do brings a level of euphoria that comes from the hormone that's in the body, primarily in the brain, called dopamine. People that seek pleasure, gratification. So somebody in what used to be called the X Games, I don't even know if they still do those, but the extreme sports, and they want that high that comes from doing something that just fills them with such energy. It could be somebody in politics that gets that same feeling, or somebody in business, or somebody in the entertainment industry. Maybe you've experienced it in some form, not as extreme as some of those things. But that euphoria, that's the dopamine. What's really interesting, and the science is seeing more of this, is that even the thought of doing the habit releases dopamine. So it may not be to the same level as doing it, but even thinking of chocolate can sometimes make you feel almost as good as actually having chocolate. And this is the problem with sin. Even thinking about it, having experienced the pleasure previously, can release that same dopamine, and so our body doesn't want to walk away from that. We want more of that. This is why sin can be so hard to overcome. So even if we think of it, that's why we need to bring every thought into captivity. Now I'm tying here together habits and overcoming. So let's consider a little bit more of how to change a habit or how to institute a new and better one. Often the problem is not that we don't recognize that a habit needs to be changed. We know if we don't get enough exercise, we don't get enough sleep, or we eat too much, or we eat too little, or we do the things that we do that we know we need to change. The problem is how we think about how that change can be accomplished. For instance, New Year's resolutions are popular every year. It's a change in the season. It's a new calendar. People are looking forward to the coming year, hoping to have a better life, and they'll make all sorts of resolutions. But the average length of time that anyone sticks with that is around 24 days, a little more than 3 weeks. Why is that? If it was a matter of willpower, you'd think more people would succeed at it. If it was environment, you'd think they could change it, these sort of things. But the really big reason why they don't do it is that most of those resolutions are too radical. They're too big in scope. I want to be as fit as I was when I was 24. That's probably not going to happen. The person tries to change too much all at once. And so they give up after a while, because then that cue and that routine and that reward doesn't happen. It's too overwhelming. In almost all circumstances, that massive action is not sustainable. So we give up. But how much change is sustainable? If we're not going to go for everything, what would be the least amount, not in a bad way, but in a sustainable way, what would be the least amount of change that is in order for us to make a significant change over time? It's 1%. 1% doesn't sound like a lot, does it? This is James Clear's point. It's not the big actions, it's the small actions. 1% over time. And a great example that can be found is in the British cycling team. In the Olympics, these are the guys that race around the track, but it's also things like Tour de France. In 2002, the British cycling team hired a man named Sir David Brailsford. They needed a new head coach because they were going nowhere. The British cycling team had managed to win one gold medal in 76 years of their history. One. Their reputation for not winning was so bad and so well known that top-tier bike manufacturers refused to sell them their bikes because they didn't want their bikes associated with a losing team, one that bad. Sir Brailsford was a former cyclist, so he understood the sport, but he was bringing to this his MBA, and he wanted to approach it from a more business perspective, and he thought that he could make a positive change. And so he implemented what is called the theory of marginal gains. This theory is simply that you don't go for the big changes, you don't go for the big overwhelming things, it's the small things added up that create the big change. Because big changes are problematic for all the reasons I've covered earlier. And I found an interview where they asked him the question why he approached this problem, if you will, this way. And this is what he said. It struck me that we should think small, not big, and adopt a philosophy of continuous improvement through the aggregation of marginal gains, adding up the small until it gets big. He said, forget about perfection, focus on progression, and compound the improvements. By experimenting in wind tunnels, he said, we searched for small improvements to aerodynamics. By analyzing the mechanics area of the team truck, we discovered that dust was accumulating on the floor, undermining bike maintenance. So we painted the floor white in order to spot any impurities. We hired a surgeon to teach our athletes about proper hand washing so as to avoid illnesses during competition. We also decided not to shake any hands during the Olympics. They didn't want to run the chance of getting sick on any level. We were precise about food preparation. We brought our own mattresses and pillows so our athletes could sleep in the same posture every night. We searched for small improvements everywhere and found countless opportunities. Taken together, we felt they gave us a competitive advantage. For strategy, we analyzed the demand of each event and spent a lot of time trying to understand what it would take to win. So just as one example, what is the power needed off the line to get the start required to achieve a winning time, and how close is each athlete to being capable of generating that power? Seems like a small thing, but this is the kind of thing that they were pondering. He says, but the whole point about our approach is that it was meant to be continuous. We learned as we went. So this 1% gain, to sort of give you a little bit of a visual here, might not be noticeable. And in fact, when we're talking about things like habits, how do you even measure what that 1% would be? And it's not so much that you can actually measure it and quantify it as 1%, because what's your baseline and where do you want to be and what does that 1% look like? It's more a matter of just imagining something very small. And probably the best way to think about it is compound interest. So a 1% improvement would gain you 3.65% at the end of the year. Now your baseline has moved up, hasn't it? And that's just one. But then as you add another 1% and another 1% and another 1%, this is what Sir David Brailsford was doing. They went so far as they would make sure before every race to make sure that the tire pressure in every tire was at the correct amount. That might seem obvious, but obviously they weren't doing it all the time. They'd probably do it regularly enough, but they made sure it was one of the things they did before every race. Seat height on a bike, you would think, would be obvious. They made sure that every bike was optimally tuned for the rider. All of these little things that might seem obvious, but obviously they weren't doing it in a way that aggregated these results. The downside to this is that if you do nothing, or you do a bad habit, that compound return is equally the other way. This is part of the reason why God asks us to overcome. It's not just that he has a standard and he's not going to stand for anything else. There is a measure of truth in that. But he doesn't want to see us fail. And that negative return of 3.65%, we're going to fail, aren't we? You start aggregating that and compounding that over 10 years, you're in a pretty deep hole. A single action to not do something or to do something is easy to dismiss. But a positive action in that regard, multiplied, is going to make great returns. But starting the good habit isn't easy, is it? We know we should eat better. We know we should exercise more. We should get better sleep, not waste so much time in meaningless activities. We know the things that we should do, but we rarely get around to implementing those habits. Because, to use another aspect of science, a body in motion tends to stay in motion. We're on a path, and the brain is lazy, and it's going to continue doing those habits because it gets some reward, and it's not likely to change. Not without some outside influence. Another big obstacle is that when we want to do something or change something in our life, we usually want results now. This is another aspect of why those New Year's resolutions fail so much. They expect to see big returns before those 3 weeks come around, and 3 weeks show up and they're still 30 pounds overweight, or they're still smoking, or they're still chewing their fingernails, and they say, I'm done. I'll just accept this and deal with it. We want results now. But we should be more concerned with our current trajectory than our current results. So if you had a laser, two lasers, and you pointed them at a target, and you moved one just a little bit, and it would have to be even just a thousandth or so of an inch, over the course of great distances, are those going to end up in the same place? Not at all. In fact, the farther out you go, the greater the distance between them. And this is part of what we're talking about. It's hard to see that difference up front, isn't it? Because they're so close. But the longer it goes on, the difference becomes greater and greater and greater. We read 1 Corinthians 11, verse 28 earlier, this examination. Oftentimes when we do this or ponder this examination, we're thinking in terms of what's wrong. And there is an element of being honest with ourselves there. But it's also equally valid to look at what we're doing right. Because if we're going to build on things, we have to know the good things to build on. Let me go back to the British cycling team and continue some of what Sir Brailsford said. He said, interestingly, when I moved from the track to Tour de France, so the racetrack that's the Olympic versus a long-distance road race like Tour de France, he said, we didn't get it right at all. Our first few races were well below expectation. They picked 1% items, and they put them into place, and he said, we failed. But he said, we tried so hard with all the bells and whistles of marginal gains that our focus was too much on the periphery and not on the core. In other words, they weren't focused on the right 1%. He says, you have to identify the critical success factors and ensure that they're in place, then focus on your improvements around them. So what are your critical success factors as a Christian? There are some very basic things, aren't there? Prayer, meditation, fasting. If those are not in place, the 1% gains are not going to get us where we want to be. What's interesting about what he did with the British cycling team is that they didn't achieve the success they were looking for the first year or the second year or the third year, or the fourth year. But at the 2008 Olympics in Beijing, the British cycling team won 60% of all gold medals. 60%. It took them 5 years to get there, didn't it? The trajectory is more important. Am I headed in the right direction? And then sticking with it. In the 2012 London Olympics, the British cycling team set 9 Olympic records and 7 world records. That same year, one of the team members, Bradley Wiggins, became the first British cyclist ever to win the Tour de France. The following year, another teammate, Chris Froome, was the Tour de France winner, and he repeated in 2015, 2016, 2017. In the 10 years from 2007 to 2017, the British cycling team and their cyclists won 178 world championships, 66 Olympic or Paralympic gold medals, and 5 Tour de France victories. But it took them the years before all that started playing out, didn't it? Another good quote here from James Clear. He says, "Good habits make time your ally. Bad habits make time your enemy." Because good habits will maximize what we're doing with that time. Bad habits end up eating up time. What we're also considering here is called the plateau of latent potential. We can fall into the trap of not seeing what we've done and put into place that might not yet be bearing fruit. The farmers, you know, I'm sure they're just itching to get out in the fields right now. But as I walk through my backyard, if I drove anything across, it'd probably sink up to the axles at this point. It's got to dry out some. We need a little more sun. We need some other things in place. But even after they plant that field, what happens? Time has to pass for everything to grow, doesn't it? It takes time for those plants, whatever they are. And then as they start to grow, they need to make sure the weeds aren't going to choke them out. And they need to wait. They need to sort of tend their fields, and they do other things. And it's months and months and months before they can see the fruit. And then even after they harvest, how good was the harvest? We're looking at this very similar thing. And the way it's put is that the plateau of latent potential is looking at work invested. That is, that work is not wasted, it's being stored. What do I mean by that? Well, if you've ever wound up a mechanical clock, that's stored energy, isn't it? It doesn't release all at once. That's a problem if it does. The clock doesn't work right. But it slowly releases the energy and it accomplishes what it's supposed to do, doesn't it? Maybe it's the money invested for retirement. You take $5,000, you put it in an IRA when you're 25, and you let it sit for the next 40 years. And initially, it doesn't look like it's doing anything. But the compound interest, year after year after year after year, and 4 decades down the road, it adds up to a pretty good return. Maybe it's time spent as studying and learning as a student. You spent 3-4 years now going through college, in your major, class after class, paper after paper, lab after lab, and it doesn't look like you're getting far. But then when you're challenged, you realize you're not the freshman that doesn't know anything about this now. You're pretty conversant in what the various field is. What determines whether we stick with a habit long enough to survive the plateau of latent potential is the key. That's where we get our success. In changing habits, or for the point of this sermon here today, in changing our spiritual habits, we need to forget about goals. And we need to focus on systems. What that means is, I want to be one of the questions they would ask at Ambassador Club, which is like a spokesman's club at Ambassador College. You know, where do you want to be? Well, hopefully one day I'll be in the kingdom. Okay, that's a goal, but it's a pretty nebulous goal, isn't it? How do you get there? What steps you need to take to make sure that you can be there? That's what systems are. Systems are breaking it down into steps. How do I get there? And that can be our undoing because we don't oftentimes think long term, do we? Life is simply what happens, and one day we wake up and we wonder how we got there. Goals are about results you want to achieve. Systems are about the processes that lead to those results. Systems are not about goals because it's not about any single accomplishment A goal is an accomplishment. Systems are about continuous refinement and improvement, like that British cycling team. They would do one or two things, and they would see what kind of return they would get. Okay, I can see a marginal improvement, and they would add another thing, and they would add another thing. And over the course of the 5 years, they kept refining everything until suddenly it looked like they appeared out of nowhere, and they began to succeed. We don't rise to the level of our goals. We fall to the level of our systems. Our systems determine where we get to. And so if we don't have the right systems, then that's where we fail. Another way of putting it, for those that are familiar with what's called strategic planning, fix the inputs and the outputs will fix themselves. We can change outcomes, what we get. We can change processes, what we do. But the deepest level of change involves what's called changing your identity. That sounds pretty radical. We tend to like who we are. But that's the problem, isn't it? We're not overcoming if we like who we are in terms of our carnal human nature. We need to change that. So how do we change that? Well, there are some simple things that we can begin to put in place. One of the very simplest is what's called the I am or the I will statements. Oftentimes, simply by saying I will, and then you state what it is. Today, I will not swear at anybody. By simply making that statement, your level of accomplishing that rises dramatically. It happens the same if you write it down. I learned this years ago with my daily planner. If I put something on my schedule for the day, more than likely I will accomplish it. If I don't write it down, it'll get pushed down the road and maybe never happen. These I am statements are simple. I am the type of person who is this. And this is why the system is important. Where do we want to be? What do we want to be? We could say, well, I want to be like Christ. I want to take on the mind of Christ. Okay, that's a goal. What's the system? How do we get there? Well, I'm not going to get there overnight. So what are the 1% that I can add and add and add and add that will get me there? When behavior and identity align, then you're simply acting like the person that you want to become. You already believe that you're that person. And a lot of people don't do this because it feels fake. I want to paint a painting, but I'm not an artist. Okay, well then you probably won't paint a painting because you'll paint it and you'll say, that's terrible, and you won't do it again. But if you say, I want to paint a painting because I'm an artist, you'll paint that and you'll say, okay, I can do better. I like this part and that part. And then you keep refining it until at some point down the road, that becomes who you are. The biggest barrier to any change, though, is this identity conflict. When our identity merges or emerges out of our habits, then we don't have that conflict. Because the more we repeat a behavior, the more we reinforce the identity associated with that behavior. And this is why overcoming is so imperative, because as we repeat sin, as we practice sin, then we reflect that in terms of who we are. But when we practice something of godly nature, practicing love, one of the things that I've heard recently, I mentioned this morning, it seems increasingly one of the hallmarks of God's people that makes them stand out from the culture around them is not swearing. Because it is so commonplace that when you don't swear, you don't even have to say anything. You show up at work and you announce to everybody, I'm not going to swear today. You don't have to say that. All you have to do is show up and do your stuff, and they're at some point going to recognize, you know what? He never swears. Something as simple as that reinforces the person that we want to be. Let's look at Proverbs 23 and verse 7 there. The context of this chapter is not what we're covering today, but there's a very powerful point made at the beginning of verse 7 here in chapter 23 for the purpose of the sermon today that I want to read. So Proverbs 23 and verse 7 very simply says at the beginning, "For as a man thinks in his heart, so is he." What we think is very powerful. "I could never be an artist" has power, because then I won't attempt to be an artist. But if I say, "I want to be like Christ," and we begin to implement that, then we start to become like Christ. We put into motion the things that we think about, because we internalize them. And once we internalize them, then we act upon them, and it becomes who we are. Let's look at a similar thought in Luke 6 and verse 45. In Luke, here in this chapter, this is the parallel account at the beginning of the chapter of what's called the Beatitudes. And then Christ goes on to discuss many other things, the concept of loving your enemies, not judging one another. But here in verses 43 to 45, he's talking about this concept of what we do outwardly reflects who we are inwardly. So in verse 45, he says, "A good man out of the treasure of his heart brings forth good." It's just axiomatic. If you're thinking good thoughts, you can go in to your work. Let's just say it's a highly toxic environment. Your boss is terrible. Your coworkers are always gossiping, backbiting, doing all these things. Nothing is good about the work. If you show up at that door and you say, "You know what, it's going to be miserable today," it probably will be. But if you show up and say, "I'm going to make the best of this. No matter what everybody else does, I'm going to make sure that I'm representing the right values here." And you probably will. It can be challenging, but nonetheless, good treasure out of the heart brings forth good. An evil man out of the evil treasure of his heart brings forth evil. So to go back to the swearing example, the people that are swearing, I can almost guarantee you they're not even thinking about what they're saying, because it has become so internalized, it's just how they speak. And it's not until they're challenged that they remember that they're saying these words. This is powerful. What are we thinking about? What are we internalizing? What's in our heart? The problem we have with viewing ourselves as something we are not currently is that we expect that new behavior to be perfect. It won't be. So many times we give up. What's interesting to consider is that children don't do this. Children are terrible at everything, aren't they? Because they don't know anything. How do you feed yourself? How do you dress yourself? Left shoe on the right foot. Okay, it works. I'm going to do it. That, you know, and at some point they realize, oh, that's not very comfortable, and they'll learn to do it right. Learning to talk, learning everything. In the first 5 years, it's been said, children learn more than the rest of their life put together. Because they're figuring out the world around them. They're figuring out their own body. They're learning everything is new. And then for the next 18 or 20 years, we seek to apply that till we get to a level of certain maturity, physically especially. But even that can change. Maybe in high school, you take a class that suddenly changes how you think about your future life. You didn't know you liked art. You didn't know you liked science. You didn't know you liked music or whatever it happens to be. And suddenly you realize you're good at something. And now behavior changes to reinforce that. Maybe it's at college. You take a class. You have a professor that just connects with you in a certain way. Because that identity is not set in stone. The problem we can have, especially as we get older, is we think, what's the point in changing? But that's that negative 1% trajectory, isn't it? It's not getting us to a better place. A personal example from my life. I never considered myself a writer. Because up until about 2006, I didn't write. I would put sermons together, but I go back and look at some of those sermons and I realize how basic they were. But when we came to this area, the previous pastor wrote what he called a Sabbath thought, and I continued that tradition. But what I was encouraged to do by Roxanne was not only continue that tradition, but make it a regular thing every week. And so I had to write. And so I had to be thinking about writing. I had to have topics to write on. after a certain amount of time, a year or two, I realized that I was pretty decent at this. Nobody was throwing shoes at me and asking me why I was sending this to them. And so then after the most recent split happened that we experienced as a church, I was asked to become the assistant managing editor of what was called the Vertical Thought magazine. I was never a staff managing editor of anything in my life, but that expanded this aspect of writing more. And then I personally expanded some of it into seeing needs that maybe I could address and help in other ways. And so now I write a leadership newsletter that goes out to everyone once a month, to then the speakers, the men that are up here song leading, giving messages. I send a speaker's newsletter once a month. And the interesting thing is the more you do anything, the better you get at it, right? And again, the converse to this is sin. The more we practice sin, the better we get at sinning. That's not a good thing. So thinking of these things in these terms, you know, as I became a writer, as I began to think of myself as a writer, then I asked for a responsibility. And about 3 or so months ago, I asked to become the assistant managing editor of what's called Ministerial Journal. This is a publication, it's digital, that's emailed out to all the elders in the United Church of God. I wanted to make sure that that got moved forward because it was sort of drifting into disuse. So I became another aspect of a writer. And again, for probably the first 40 or almost 45 years of my life, I never wrote. Never thought of myself as a writer. Let's go to Hebrews chapter 6. Hebrews 6 and verse 1. We covered this verse and the one following in a series of sermons last summer. And I want to pull this thought out here as we consider aspects of changing habits and taking on better habits and overcoming sin. Paul writes, therefore, leaving the discussion of the elementary principles of Christ, getting past the basics, let us go on to perfection. Now, that's a goal, isn't it? And we have to be careful with goals because they're so big. How do we get there? But then he fleshes this out in the next two verses. We have processes. We have systems to go through here. We don't, again, lay the foundation of dead works and of faith. We're adding to this doctrine of baptism, laying on of hands, and these other aspects that we covered. We're building on it. And each of those things can be broken down into finer and finer aspects. When we consider our calling, anybody that's been here very long, let me just ask the question. How many here are baptized and have been more than 40 years? Okay, so look around and see those hands. Ask any one of them, when they were baptized, if they thought they would be where they are now when they were baptized. I can almost guarantee you every one of them would say, I had no idea. You know, I never would have thought in my wildest imaginations, not only that I would be an elder, but I would be a pastor. All of those things happened in small steps over time. Anyone that has been baptized, you're adding to your calling little steps at a time. God leads us through trials. We covered that a couple of weeks ago, so that we build and we build and we build and we build on the calling that he has given us. And when considering this thought here of going on to perfection, I want to tie it back to those I am or those I will statements. I am a child of God. How do I put that into practice? How do I take those 1% steps and build on that and compound that so that I become like Christ? More importantly, do we put actions in our life that show that we believe and value that very thing? To change our identity and then to overcome wrong habits, we simply need to apply this 1% rule. And it's a very simple thing. What do you want to become? And what do you want to have in your spiritual life? What do you want to become? This is part of the examination as well. I looked at when I wrote, and when I realized I had some degree of talent for it, that maybe I could do more. Maybe I could do better. And you begin to add to these things. If you want to write like Mr. Patterson, then each page you write reminds you that you are a writer. And you establish the habit that I am going to write. If you want to be an artist, then each drawing you make reminds you that you're an artist. Doesn't matter how people care about that. Maybe they think you're horrible. This is one of the great things about being a kid, right? You draw that drawing, you give it to your mom, she says, "Oh, that's amazing," and she puts it on the refrigerator. She doesn't care how good it is. What she cares is that you think you're an artist. Each responsibility you take on reminds you that you are a leader. And one of the basic statements about what good leadership is that I really value is that leadership is influence. Who do you influence? And every time you do that, what kind of leader are you? We simply build on these 1% changes again and again and again and again until we actually become the thing we want to become. And so this shifts habit from outcome-based to identity-based. It's not just things we check off. It becomes who we are. In the corporate world, again, this is called strategic planning. And in considering those things on a corporate level, basically what you're asking is, where do I want to end up? And then what steps do I need to take to get there? And you measure that, and you're always adjusting. And maybe at some point, one of the values is you didn't ask the right question. You start collecting information, you realize, no, that's not where I want to be. I want to be over here instead. And so then you adjust. There's still value in knowing those things. This is the examination. Lastly, let's look at Romans 4, verse 17 there. Romans 4 and verse 17. Paul here, writing about Abraham, breaking into thought, he says, "As it is written, I have made you a father of many nations, in the presence of him who he believed, God who gives life to the dead and calls those things which do not exist as though they did." I find this verse very powerful for the point of what we're covering here today, because God himself is working his system. I don't know how often we think about that. We talk about this at times. God's plan of salvation for mankind is a system. What is God doing? Way back in whatever we would want to call eternity, before there was anything else, there was the Godhead. And they decided, for whatever reason and purpose that they decided, they wanted to have more in a family. So what was their first step? They didn't just create everything and there it was. They did it in stages. So you had the spirit world that was created. And then after who knows how much time, how did God interact with them? What did he teach them? What kind of conversations did they have? Did he explain to them what he was going to do after he created them and so forth? We don't know, but I suspect he did have those kind of conversations. Then he created the physical universe around us. Then he created mankind, placed them here on earth. And then he's explained to some of us that he's given his spirit to what that's all about. That he's going to bring all of mankind that will submit to him, that will take on his nature and become like him. That he's going to make them part of his family. Those are all steps, aren't they? God is doing the very same thing we're talking about here today. And it's an amazing thing to consider, and it's very powerful, all that God is doing and how we can reflect that. This topic of overcoming is a very deep one. And there's more that I want to cover because I want to give you some very concrete steps of how to accomplish what I've introduced to you today. But one sermon is not enough. But we're going to end here for now. But next time I'm here in Milwaukee, we'll conclude this topic with part 2 of Habits and Overcoming.